Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and it's June 17, 2014. I want to bring on my first guest, Steve Kaufman. He has co-authored Good News for All Creation and is the author of Guided by the Faith of Christ, Seeking to Stop Violence and Scapegoating. He's the chair of the Christian Vegetarian Association and the co-chair of the Medical Research Modernization Committee. He's also an association professor in the Department of Ophthalmology of Case School of Medicine. He is a retinal specialist and a partner of Vitreoretinal Consultants. Welcome to It's All About Food, Steve. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
It's been a while since we've chatted.
Indeed.
So you're doing well.
I am, thanks. And I saw your recent video. It looks like you're doing well as well.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's amazing where the universe can lead you sometimes. As I mentioned in the film and what he's talking about, I've been talking about a bunch on this program, where I was invited by a feedlot owner to participate on a panel about climate change and animal agriculture's contribution to climate change to about 250 cattle producers. And I went. It was an incredible opportunity. I was really overwhelmed with how nice everybody was.
You know, that's the thing. You know, it's been my experience that farmers, cattle ranchers and all the like are really pleasant people. They're outgoing, gregarious, and fun. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're nice to animals.
Yeah.
But at a superficial level, at that level, you know, they can be a very friendly crowd and a pleasure to be with. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're nice to everybody.
but it's important to know that, because I think a lot of people shy away from talking with people that they don't agree with because they're afraid.
A lot of people will accept respectful engagement. It's not always easy to respectfully engage when you have strong passions about what's going on. But we should respectfully engage everybody for two reasons. One is, that's just the right thing to do. And the other is, you're not going to get anywhere with anyone if you're not respectful towards them.
Now, I want to focus a little bit on the Christian's perspective,
sure.
Because you're a specialist in that field, and I'm always looking for different angles and different communities to extend this message about compassion and kindness to animals. And I think the Christian community is an ideal place for the vegetarian, vegan message because of all of the things that are taught about kindness and giving. Where's the disconnect?
Well, I mean, it's also important because so many people identify themselves as Christian and use the Bible and or Christian tradition as the foundation for their moral decisions. So although the secular case for animal rights is strong and the case for animal protectionism in just about every religion is strong, to many Christians, the arguments or considerations are going to come from that faith tradition. But why is there a disconnect? That's a tough question to answer, but I can give you some thoughts on it.
Yeah.
For one thing, people like to eat animals, and people like to defend whatever they do. and so, you know, this is what people do from all walks of life. And so, to some degree, people fashion the religion to suit their needs. That happens in just about all religions. The curious thing is that there's this element in the Judeo-Christian tradition which is so strongly pro-animal, and I think that indicates that at least some level of consciousness, people want to be at peace with animals. They don't really want to hurt animals. They want to have animals as their friends, but at the same time, they also want to eat them. So there's a conflict there, which is one of the reasons why it's hard to talk about this, because I think a lot of people recognize that their value is not to harm animals, and yet their practice, a practice they don't wish to change, involves harming animals. Another thing that makes it difficult for Christianity to take a leadership role is that so much of Christianity is institutionalized. Institutions tend to be self-propagating and self-defending. And so if the people out there are saying, you know, we really do like to eat animals, then the church leaders are going to say, okay, it's okay to eat animals.
Yeah.
They're going to be very hesitant to take a leadership role for fear of losing members of their congregation. And so the interesting thing was that the earliest Christian churches were really home churches at best. People just get together at various people's houses and discuss the Jesus stories and what that meant for them. Those were the first churches, and they didn't have buildings to support. They didn't have pastor salaries to worry about. So you didn't have those sorts of issues that bring in other considerations that make it hard for churches to address the really tough questions, social questions, one of them, of course, being the animal issues. But there's others as well that churches are hesitant to confront because it's just too touchy.
I'm wondering about institutions versus gathering at home and having compelling conversations and discussions, if one is better than the other.
Well, at least in terms of moving things forward and exploring new ideas, if you don't have institutions to defend and support, you don't have to worry about that. Then you can take more chances.
Right.
And because the worst that happens is someone gets a bit angry or offended, and you try to smooth things over. But, you know, in a church, if a pastor gets up there and says, you know, look at what we're doing to these poor animals, look what we're doing to the earth, we've got to, you know, change the way we eat, a lot of people are going to head for the door and not come back. And that's just the reality of it. They're going to go to a church that says, you know, there's no such thing as global warming, or at least don't worry about it. Your contribution is so negligible that you just do what you want to do, and we'll continue to serve meat at our events, and you'll feel comfortable here.
Shall I dare say that many of us are hypocrites?
Well, I mean, all of us struggle to lead the perfect life, and all of us fall short in that regard. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I think that hypocrisy is more when your intent is so much in conflict with what you know is right and true. But that people, you know, don't always live up to the ideal that they would want. I mean, most of us would say the ideal is to have a very low impact on the earth and its inhabitants. And yet there's other things that we like to do with our lives that sometimes have an impact on the earth. And so it's a struggle to lead a good and righteous life, in Christianity, as well as just about any other faith tradition and secular ethics as well, says that's true. Let's explore the questions. Let's see how we can do the best we can as a community, as individuals and as a community.
Now, I know a lot of people like to quote the Bible as evidence of something that should be done or not done. Is there some compelling evidence in the scriptures that tell us about what we should eat and not eat?
Well, sure, there's a lot of different passages. I mean, you can obviously, as you're probably well aware, you can defend just about any position on anything if you pick certain passages, you know, and especially if they don't come out the way you want them to, you just say that it's metaphor, and this means that, and that means that.
There's a lot of leeway.
It's the heads I win, tails you lose kind of thing. But there are some passages that are certainly animal-friendly. Two that come to mind and I think are perhaps most central for those of us in the Christian Vegetarian Association are in Genesis 1, in which all creatures as well as humanity is instructed to eat plant food. And it's a world of peaceful coexistence, which is described by the Bible as the ideal. It's not a world in which we live in now, because there's a lot of animals that would not survive if they didn't eat other animals. But at least it points to what the ideal is, and I think many Christians would agree that we should try to live according to the ideal, even if it's impossible to achieve the ideal the way the world is constructed currently. Which is ironic, because in Genesis 1:26, a favorite passage of those who want to defend eating animals and say God made animals for us to eat them, it describes how humanity was given dominion over the animals, but this was a world in which no animal or human harmed each other.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever was intended by the writer of that passage to communicate, it wasn't exploitation, abuse, or tormenting non-humans. It was probably similar to what, because of the same word, of what is described as the proper role of a king, who has dominion over his subjects. He's not supposed to exploit and abuse them. He's supposed to be a good ruler who rules with wisdom and compassion and is really a servant to the people and an emissary for God, not someone who's supposed to take advantage of his position of power.
And the king doesn't eat his servants either.
True enough. And then in Isaiah, the description of the so-called peaceable kingdom or realm of God, in which the wolf will lie with the lamb and the little child will lead them, that passage was just quite well known. Again, it's an image at the end of time in which all creatures, including humanity, live in harmony and peaceful coexistence. So that's where you get a biblical ideal. There's a lot of other passages where animals are eaten or used, but that's a world in which the ancient Hebrews, it was the world in which they lived. They needed to use animals in various ways to survive. But interestingly, the Bible also puts restrictions on how animals are to be killed. For example, if the knife, it has to be a cutting of the throat with a single cut, and the blade cannot have a nick in it. So at that time, that was the most humane way possible to kill an animal. I think we can do better today, but back then that was the best that they could do in terms of killing the animal. And it was forbidden, for example, to cut off a limb of an animal and then pack the wound and eat the animal piece by piece, which unfortunately was common practice back then.
Mm.
But the ancient Hebrews said, no, you can't do that, because even though there's no refrigeration and even though that's a more efficient way to eat an animal under the circumstances, it was just so cruel that they could not countenance it. So, but it gives you an idea that the ancient Hebrews, although animal exploitation was permitted, they were doing their best to minimize abuse. And so the Bible does not endorse at any point cruelty to animals or gratuitously harming animals. And as Norm Feltz has pointed out, the biblical case for slavery is much, much stronger, human slavery is much, much stronger than the biblical case for animal abuse.
Are there different Christian communities that are more open to this vegan, vegetarian message than others?
Yeah, I would say so. Now, the Seventh-day Adventists, a lot of them are vegan. It's for health reasons, and they are have variable interest in animal welfare and animal rights per se, but they do think that, we should eat according to the Genesis diet, which is a plant-based diet. And feel that anything other than that is an unhealthy diet. They've got a point there.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside of that, there may be very small sects or groups that adopt such a diet. There's a group called the Hebrew Israelites. It's a very small group, which is vegan. But again, I think it's more for health reasons and Genesis mm-hmm. 1, following Genesis 1 than anything else, not necessarily animal protectionism. Then, of course, within Christianity, there's a lot of individuals. I mean, we have over 7,000 members in our Christian Vegetarian Association, but we come from all walks of life, from very liberal to very conservative. I'd say that the liberal Christians are more inclined to a vegan or vegetarian diet, but we certainly have a lot of very conservative Christians who are members of our group, and for very much the same reasons, theologically, and that it's just part of their Christian witness that they feel that, we're supposed to care for God's creatures, and they can't participate in activities that are the exact opposite of that.
And what is the Christian Vegetarian Association up to these days?
Well, we still distribute over 100,000 booklets at Christian events, concerts, revivals, and the like. And we're coming out with a new booklet. It's going to be a little bit more up-to-date with the way people read, which is
exhibits.
Uh-huh. I try to make it a little more reader-friendly. I think that is something that will help our message be well received. And then we just continue to be a resource for people who have questions. We have a Yahoo groups called Christian VEG Yahoo group, where we provide information and support for each other. It's a moderated list, by the way, and so all the messages are respectful. I believe mm-hmm. the ones that are not. we're doing what we've been doing, and hopefully the message will get out there more and more over time. I think we're making progress in several fronts, in part because I think people are realizing that unless we change the way we are living, we're not going to have human civilization as we know it for much longer. And I think if anybody is of an interest of having children, they probably have a strong desire to see human civilization flourish.
Yeah.
And So unless they've got their head in the sand, you know, I would think that the wise choice is either do your best to help create a sustainable world, or at the very least, don't have kids, because what are we giving them? I mean, if we really want them to inherit a world that sees inadequate resources to keep itself going, that's not a world that I would.
Yeah.
I'd want to be. I don't want to be there when that happens.
Yeah, and you don't want the people you love to be there when
that's
that happens.
Point.
Yeah.
That's my point.
No. Oh, okay. You saw the film. I mentioned a couple of things in the film. One was the Dominion concept, which you spoke briefly about.
Right.
And the other, I don't know if it's in the film. I think it is briefly. I told my audience early on in my presentation that I don't believe in killing anything, and then
right.
I said, thou shalt not kill.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that means, thou shalt not kill, one of those commandments?
Well, you know, these things are open to a variety of interpretations, and I don't claim to have the final answer. For me, it means don't kill anything, at least unnecessarily. I would say thou shalt not murder is probably a better way to translate it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that you can certainly murder a non-human.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what was intended by the writer of that passage, I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah.
But for me, at least, it makes the most sense to see it as killing any individual unnecessarily. And obviously, the vast majority of the time when humans are killing non-humans, it's unnecessarily.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to know a little bit more about your practice as a retinal specialist.
Well, you know, we treat retinal diseases like macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy and retinal detachments, the sorts of things that retina specialists do.
Now, when we talk about plant-based diets and good nutrition, with some of those, like macular degeneration, there is a connection, is there
Absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. And at least on theoretical grounds, you know, a plant-based diet is going to be very good for you. I don't think there's any really strong evidence one way or the other about whether animal-based products are harmful to the eye that way. I mean, except insofar as if you get a heart attack and die, then you also go blind. But but just because that's what happens when you die. but I don't think it has. I'm not sure whether it has a direct effect on the eye. But certainly the plant-based foods are going to be good for you. And if that's and it's you know, the typical American diet, I think, is not optimal at all for eye health. Insofar as it's so much animal-based and lacks a lot of the. Particularly the green leafy vegetables are good for you, as well as carrots, as you know. And
Do you ever get an opportunity?
You won't hurt yourself if you overdose on carrots, but you will start to turn a little bit orange.
Right. But do you ever get to talk to your patients about nutrition you're treating them?
Yeah. Oh, sure. But you know, I'm not in a great position to say you should be vegan. You know, I can't really back that up with a lot of scientific evidence, but I certainly talk about the importance of moving towards plant-based diet and broader consumption of those and that sort of thing.
Right, because I know so many medical professionals are afraid to talk about diet with their patients, and patients need to hear it over and over and over and over from people that they respect.
Well, that's true. That's true. And particularly for a lot of other medical conditions, the case is much stronger. And we know that, you know, it's crazy that from Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Ornish and work such as theirs, that the plant-based diets are the ones that are going to save their life. And not telling the patients that. Now, the patient may say, I don't want that, and that's the patient's choice. But the patients aren't even hearing, you know, there's a way that you can live. Some people find it difficult and some people don't, but you can survive.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't even talk about it. I think in part because it really does take a lot of work. And doctors don't have a lot of time now for patients. It's an unfortunate aspect. There's a lot of reasons behind that. And it's not just, you know, the notion that doctors just try to make more money. It's there's been changes in the way healthcare is reimbursed and run, ways that make it difficult for doctors to find the time that it takes to really give people the advice and support that they need. It's an unfortunate situation.
Do you have any thoughts on the current Pope?
It sounds like, you know, he's somewhat friendly towards animals, which is a nice thing.
Yep.
But again, you know, when the followers lead, the leaders will follow. And so
they have to lead better.
But my point is that there the way the followers have to be the ones to say we want different kinds of leadership, because as long as the followers are saying that this is what we this is what we want to hear, then that's what they're going to hear. So on the one hand it can be frustrating, but on the other hand it can be liberating, because leaders normally will want to be conservative, because after all they got where they were through the existing institution. So there's a lot of potential for the grassroots who are not so invested in the conservative institution to say we want fundamental changes in the way our communities or institutions are run. So there's ways to look at that aren't so despairing.
The people have the power.
They do.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good thing, because if the leaders were the only ones with the power, they probably wouldn't change very much. After all, that's how, through the existing system is how they got to where they are.
But I guess I haven't really looked at it this way, but it sounds like the leaders aren't really leading.
No,
they're just taking what they're getting and just going along with it.
I mean, after all, the Pope is just a human being.
Oh.
Right? and the Pope only has immense power because a lot of other human beings have invested the Pope with that power. That's the only reason. Otherwise, he's just another person.
Right, just another human being. Okay, well, before we go, do you have some wise words for us how we can move forward?
Well, there's
on this planet of ours.
There's a Hindu saying that when you're ready, your guru will find you. I think that what we have to do is be that guru and keep on hitting people with the message over and over again. And when people are finally ready for that message, then they'll say, "Ah, gee, I'm glad I thought of that."
I like that. I like that a lot, because for so many of us, it can be so frustrating to keep on with this message. But people need to hear it over and over again.
We shouldn't try to convert people. We should try to facilitate people converting themselves by asking questions, bringing up facts, not telling people what to think or do, but rather just to say, this is what I do, this is why I do it, and then people say, maybe that's right for me. And so that because people need to feel empowered as well, and they need to sort of have a sense that that this is their choice, not imposed on them by anybody else.
Yeah, well, when I was talking to those cattlemen and women, those cattle people, I never told them what to do.
Sure.
I want to think that I did move some cells around inside themselves where they started questioning. And I like the way you put it, where at some point it'll be their idea to change.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave it at that. Let's make it everyone else's idea to make this world a better place.
Right.
Okay, thanks, Steve, for taking the time and talking to me today. And all the best to you and the Christian Vegetarian Association. And I look forward to that new booklet coming out.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
We're going to take a little break now, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay with us.